Chapter 7. For many years, Stephen Maturin, as an intelligence agent chiefly concerned with naval affairs, had been harassed, worried, and deeply distressed by the activities of highly placed, well-informed men, admirers of Napoleon, who, from inside the English administration, sent information to France. Their messages usually had to do with the movement of ships, and they'd caused the loss of several men of war, the failure of attacks whose success depended on surprise, the interception of convoys with the capture of sometimes half the merchantmen, and, which wounded Stephen and his chief, Sir Joseph Blaine, even more intimately, the taking of British agents in all the unfortunate countries forming part of Bonaparte's shoddy empire. With the help of a man belonging to one of the French intelligence services, sick of his trade and fearing betrayal, Stephen and Sir Joseph had discovered the identity of two of these traitors. Andrew Ray, the acting Second Secretary of the Admiralty, and his friend Ledward, an important Treasury official. But the arrest was bungled, the pursuit lacked zeal, and they both escaped to France. Clearly they were protected by someone more highly placed by far, someone of their own way of thinking. Stephen had dealt with Ledward and Ray when the creatures went to Pula Prabang, part of a mission designed to bring about the alliance between the Sultan and France, whilst Stephen was the political adviser to a mission with the contrary intent. He had indeed dissected them. Yet their protector, or possibly protectors, had still not been found. And after a discreet pause, the flow of information had begun again, less ample, less purely naval, equally dangerous. He squared to his writing desk in the great cabin, the only place where he could conveniently spread out his copy, his code books and his dispatches. "My dear Joseph," he wrote in their first private code, the code each knew by heart, "how I wish, oh, how I wish that this, the first of writing, may reach you by the whaler Daisy bound for Sydney, and then by the most expeditious means, India and then overland, the governor has at his disposal. I believe the million to one chance has served us. Pray think of a duke, well at court, with the garter, though lame of a leg, and with curious weight." "Come in." "Which it's all hands, sir, if you please," said Killick. "Compliments to the captain, and beg to be excused," said Stephen, darting a reptilian look at him. "All hands." Of course, that was the pipe he'd heard some minutes before. "With curious ways. Before he was a duke, before he had become attached to the ministry, before he was a privy councillor, and before he had the garter, I saw him in Holland." "Come in." It was the little girl, smiling and bobbing, dressed in new frocks with blue bows on their sleeves. "You said you'd like to see us when we were ready," said Sarah. "And very fine you are too," said Stephen. "Turn round, will you?" They slowly revolved, holding their arms well away from their stiff skirts. "The elegant frocks of the world, so they are. But, Emily, my dear, what is that in your cheek?" "Nothing," said Emily, beginning to grizzle. "Put it out, put it out. Would you shame us all by chewing tobacco before the King of the Friendly Islands himself?" He held out a waste paper basket and slowly, unwillingly, Emily let drop her quid. "There, there," he said, kissing them. "Blow your nose and run along. You mustn't keep Mr. Martin waiting. There's not a moment to be lost." "You will come along, sir, won't... will not you, if ever you can?" asked Sarah. "I saw him in Holland House," wrote Stephen. And leaning back for a fresh vision of the scene, he heard Jack, in another world, address the crowded deck. To starboard, the Liberty men, who had somehow, after a day of strenuous toil, found time and energy to put on their shore-going clothes of brass-buttoned light blue jackets, white duck trousers, embroidered shirts, broad-brimmed, ribboned hats, neat little shoes with bows. To larboard, those now jaded souls who had had their fun the night before, and a cruel hard day on top of it. Those who were to go ashore, well, already the fires were burning for the feast, could hardly wait for their captain to be done. They jigged up and down as they stood, as they jigged so the stolen nails, bolts, pieces of old iron for trading, jangled in their places of concealment. "I repeat, shipmates," he said loud and clear, "we weigh with the first of the ebb. All hands are to repair to the boats the moment the second rocket goes up. They'll have 5 minutes from the first in which to take their leave, and there are to be no women aboard the ship, no women at all. Do you hear me there?" "What about Mrs. Oakes?" called a half-drunk voice from the sullen larboard. "Take that man's name, Mr. West," said Jack. And those who had been close to the butcher moved away from him with expressionless faces, leaving him isolated. "Gig's crew away," called Jack. A few moments later, he went down the side in some state, and Stephen returned to his letter. "I saw him in Holland House during the peace, when he had just come back from the Paris embassy. As the door opened, Lady Holland was saying in that loud, metallic voice of hers, 'How I worship that Napoleon!' Some people looked embarrassed, but for a moment he stood there in the shadow of the doorway with his hands clasped and his face shining as though he had been granted the beatific vision. Then he composed himself and walked in with the ordinary commonplace remarks. Lady Holland ran to meet him. 'What news from Paris? Tell us all about your dinner with the divine First Consul.' Now, this man shared in Ledward's and Ray's dirtiest parties, but although he'd been to school with Ledward, he never acknowledged him in public, nor, of course, Ray. But the point that carried total conviction with me was that their code for him was Pillywinks, and the name we found so often but could not interpret in Ray's criminally negligent papers. To carry the same conviction to your mind, let me tell you about my source. She is the lady who blew Mr. Cayley's head off with a double-barreled gun some years ago. And as you will recall, which I didn't at the time, our fellow member Harry Essex had her sentence commuted to transportation. It was therefore in New South Wales that she joined our company. There followed a succinct account of their voyage, its interruption, and its present aims. A more detailed account of his walk with Clarissa, in which he couldn't refrain from the briefest notice of Sir Joseph's beetles, and then as detailed an account as he could remember of their conversation about Ledward, Ray, and the lame man, both at the first mention of their names and during the walk down to the Strand, a long walk and made longer by the blister. The exact sequence wasn't always easy, and to fix it, he sometimes gazed out of the window. The frigate lay stern on to the shore, a shore lined with fires and as brilliant as could be. No moon to interfere, leaping flames above an incandescent heart, white sand, dark green looming behind, a blue-black sky. The whaler clearly lit upon his right, and all along the line, straight young brown bodies dancing to the sound of rhythmic song and drums. But dancing in a series of exact, perfect evolutions that would have put the brigade of guards to shame. Advance, retreat, and twirl. Twirl, retreat, advance. A half turn, and so back again. The close ranks and files interchanging, all with a perfect simultaneity of pace and waving arms. In the middle, beyond the fire, a temporary roof of palm fronds had been set up, and here, by the chief's side, sat Jack. Then other notables. To their right, Clarissa and her husband. Then Wainwright and Dr. Falconer, Reed, Martin, and the little girls now hung with wreaths of flowers, staring with amazement and delight. They were all slowly, absently sipping kava in coconut cups from the ancestral bowl in front of the chief. Back to his coding. The fires dazzling in his eyes. And he struck out several lines in which the sequence was mistaken. To convey the perfectly convincing, ingenuous nature of her words was, he feared, beyond his powers. But certainly their exact, inconsequential train might do something towards it. When next he looked up, he realized that for some time he had been hearing neither song nor drums, but a confused din not unlike the roar of a bullfight. It was, in fact, a boxing match. He'd heard of the sport forever, but curiously enough, he'd never seen a formal contest. Nothing more than scuffles among the boys in earlier commissions or dockside brawls, yet this appeared to be a singular battle. He took up his small spyglass, never far from hand, and his first astonished impression was confirmed. There were two fine, upstanding young women setting about one another with bare fists. Violent, whole-hearted blows, and judging from the cries of the onlookers, well given and well received. Clarissa was laughing. The little girls hardly knew how they liked it. Some of the seamen and all of the islanders backed one girl or the other with the greatest zeal, yet at the very climax, and for no reason that Stephen could see, when neither was giving an inch, the old chief beat the carver bowl, an attendant blew on a conch, the chief's sister intervened, the two young women fell back and walked off, one rubbing her cheek, the other her bosom. There was a cry of disappointment from the seamen who had enjoyed it, but almost immediately afterwards, from one end of the line to the other, came baked hogs, baked dogs, fishes and fowls wrapped in leaves, yams, plantains, breadfruit. Stephen's watch uttered its tiny silver chime, and looking at the pile of sheets he had so inconsiderately filled, he said, "Holy Mary, Mother of God, I shall never get all this recoded in time. And already my poor boiled eyes are dropping out of my head." He put on his green shade, wiped away his tears, changed his spectacles, and opened the new code book. He didn't look up again until a great howl plucked him from his task, his mechanical work. There was Awkward Davies, flat on his face, with a burly islander sitting on him, pinning him down with an arm-breaking hold. Davies presumably gave some sign, uttered some word, for the islander got off, helped him up, and led him back to his friends in the kindest way. Again Stephen's watch struck. And while it was still striking, the first rocket soared up. "Ooh!" cried all the people, and "Ah!" followed by cheers as it burst. The second rocket, not a quarter of a page later, was followed by nautical cries, and then by the arrival of the boats. Some few hands had contrived to get drunk on the chief's carver, but most came aboard very quietly, welcomed in a low way by the harbour watch. When his sheep had been counted, Jack looked into the cabin. "Am I interrupting you?" he asked from the doorway. "Never in life, my dear, I'm only copying. Let me finish my group when I'm with you." Many years before this, Jack, no fool at sea, had perceived that Stephen was more than a ship's surgeon, more even than a man whose political advice would be sought by a captain where relations with foreigners were concerned. And gradually, his close connection with intelligence had become so evident that there was nothing strange about his coding messages, sometimes of surprising length. The group finished. Stephen put a small lead weight upon the place and said, "I trust you had an agreeable evening." "Very agreeable, thank you. The chief did the thing handsomely, uncommon handsomely. And then nobody ran, there were no harsh words, the only fighting was in play, and we ate like aldermen. Such turtles, Stephen. But I'm afraid Bondon and Davies will need your attention in the morning. And Emily was sick." "What happened to them?" "Bondon boxed with an islander and his nose is knocked sideways. Davies was cruelly wrenched and twisted in wrestling. And somebody told Emily how the carver she'd drunk was made." "Then she is now wiser than I am. Why, they sit round an enormous pot chewing carver root. And when it's chewed enough, they spit it in, going on until there are gallons of it, and then they let it ferment. The notion made her vomit. Though it is true she'd already eaten an extraordinary amount of sugar cane and was already looking green about the gills. She may survive. I'm just going to write Sophie something of a letter before turning in. Have you any message?" "Love, of course. I had hoped to write to Diana, but I doubt I shall have time for anything more than the briefest note." "Then I shall not keep you a moment longer," said Jack, moving over to a table at the far end of the broad cabin. Their pens scratched away bell after muffled bell. At one point Stephen heard Jack tiptoe off to his sleeping cabin, and slowly the first code turned into the perhaps impenetrable second. At last, when his eyes couldn't bear the darting from one page to another any more, he took off his spectacles, covered his eyes with his hands, and pressed hard for several minutes. While he was in this state of coruscating darkness, he heard the boatswain's pipe and his fine, determined voice, "All hands on board ship! All hands there! Tumble up, you dormice!" And when he took his hands away, he saw the first hint of coming day on the shore. With a fresh urgency, he recoded the words, "How it can be accomplished, I do not know, but I shall try to get her back to England with another copy of this. May I rely upon you to protect her? Little do I know of the law, but although she is now married to a naval officer, I fear she may be molested as having returned before her time. She has already given us this piece of information, one of the most valuable that has ever come into our hands. She is potentially a valuable source of more if handled with extreme discretion. And in any event, I have a great kindness for her. Immunity would be politically sound, privately obliging. Lastly, my dear Jay, may I beg you to send the enclosed scribble down to my wife?" All this last hour there had been confused roaring and bawling beyond the reach of his concentrated attention. Now, as he ranged his papers, the cry of "Heave and awash!" came from forward. The cabin was already full of light. Mr. Adams knocked at the door. "Captain's compliments, sir, and if you have anything for Sydney, we should wrap it now. I have his own dispatch still open, and as soon as Mr. Wainwright has seen us through the channel, he'll take it back to the Daisy." "Will you clap on that goddamn capful there? Are you asleep?" asked Captain Aubrey, very strong and clear, very far from pleased. Dr. Maturin and Mr. Adams looked at one another, startled. They had both of them heard many more orders than were usual in unmooring ship, more, louder and angrier, but none so severe as this. And in a low tone, Stephen, waving his last sheet, said, "Let's allow the ink to dry and I'm with you." They wrapped, sealed, taped, tied, and sealed again. Oakes came below to ask if they were ready. "In 4 minutes," they said. And when they came on deck, they found Captain Aubrey looking at his watch, Mr. Wainwright poised by the gangway, and his boat's crew looking anxiously up. Hurried farewells, and the whaleboat shoved off. The surprise filled her foretopsail, and holding her breath, she weathered the outermost spur of the reef. Stephen stood right aft, watching Anamooka diminish astern, and then, quite small now, swing steadily round until it was abreast, as the surprise crossed that clearly marked line in the sea, that sudden change from aquamarine to royal blue, which marked the limit of the local tides and breezes on the one hand, and the steady wind from the east-southeast on the other. The long, even turn in which the ship was accompanied by three molting man-o-war birds brought the wind upon the beam, and Captain Aubrey, having increased sail steadily until she was under t'gallants, gave the course nor'east to half-east, and went below, leaving a nervous silence behind him. His breakfast was ready, but although two places were laid, his usual companion wasn't there. "Which is still in his sick berth," said Killick, "setting Davies and Bondon to rights. I could fetch him in a moment." Jack shook his head and poured himself a cup of coffee. "Infernal lubbers," he muttered to himself. In point of fact, Stephen was rolling pills in the dispensary and listening with half an ear to Martin's reasons for having deserted him in favour of Falconer. They were untrue. And Martin, feeling that they didn't persuade, plunged deep into circumstantial detail, which diminished him in Stephen's opinion. He wasn't much opposed to falsehood in itself, nor offended by its skilful use, but one of Martin's most amiable characteristics had been an ingenuous candour. In the sick berth itself, where Bondon and Davies were lying in as much comfort as could be expected, medical art having done what little it could, visitors had come below to tell them how lucky they were to have escaped the wrath on deck. "I've never seen him so vexed since he came back to the barkey off the Dry Tortugas and found Mr. Babington had let her get a foul hawse," said Place. "A round turn and an elbow it was," said Bondon, in the voice of one with a very heavy cold or a nose newly broken. "An horrible sight. He choked poor Mr. Babington off till he nearly cried. Quite pitiful to see." "But that was nothing to this," said Archer. "That was ignorance and folly, the fruit of youth, as the Bible says. This was ill will between the oak apples and the rest, and it very nearly made us miss our tide. I shouldn't wonder if he flogged the whole ship's company come Monday with bosun touching up his mate." "My conscience is quite clear, anyway," said Williams. "That'll be a great comfort to you when you get a bloody shirt on Monday, mate." "He had the smiting line set up 7 times before he was satisfied. Swore something cruel." "Smiting line? You'll grow acquainted with a smiting line come Monday," said awkward Davies with his rare grating laugh. Martin, abandoning justification as unprofitable and feeling shy of telling Maturin about his expedition with Dr. Falconer, turned to the frightful din of the early morning, oaths such as he had never heard, objurgations. "You were no doubt asleep with balls of wax in your ears," he said, "otherwise you couldn't have failed to hear the thunder of the captains and the shouting." It appears that the manoeuvres were so ill executed that Captain Aubrey became uneasy for his tide, that in another 5 minutes the land breeze would have headed us. "I wonder that an officer of his experience..." "Be so good as to pass me the quicksilver. We shall be needing it soon, no doubt. You know as well as I do that it is the one true specific for the pox." Martin reached the bottle across, and looking anxiously at Stephen, he said, "I hope I've not offended you." "As far as I'm concerned, Captain Aubrey is wholly infallible in the conduct of a ship. Pray tell me about your walk with Dr. Falconer." "It was not nearly so successful as I'd hoped. While we were taking a short cut over a tumble of black rocks, Dr. Falconer fell, twisted his ankle, and broke his spyglass. We couldn't go on, neither could we go back until the extreme pain had diminished. So we sat there on the rocks in the sun talking about volcanoes. For this formation, it seems, was of recent igneous origin. Presently we decided to eat and, above all, to drink. But it was found that although we had collecting bags, nets and specimen cases in plenty, the knapsack and the bottles had been left behind. He desired me to go to some palms right down by the shore and bring back some coconuts. And when at last I came back empty-handed, in spite of my most earnest endeavours to climb even the most oblique of the little grove, he was surprisingly impatient. Yet in time he recovered his equanimity and told me at length about the frequent volcanic activity in these regions. He believes there is an intimate connection between eruptions particularly submarine eruptions, and those great waves that devastate so many shores, wrecking ships and drowning thousands. And he was exceedingly put out by having to leave Oahu before he had climbed the volcano there, since he'd hoped to establish a relation between its intermittent rumbling and the level of the sea. He'd made his way up a far more important, far more active volcano in the Sandwich Islands, one of many. And I heard a great deal about scoriae, ashes, incandescent dust, the various forms of lava, lapilli and vitreous pumice. You'll remember that Dr. Falconer has an unusually loud voice. It seemed louder still under that torrid sun, and perhaps there was an effect of echo. We saw no birds, apart from two very distant boobies and a common sooty tern. Yet on our slow and halting return, which took us through gentler, more shaded country, I found him more interesting. He spoke of the importance of volcanoes to the Polynesians. Apart from anything else, they are visible gods, and sacrifices are often made to them in the hope of evading the usual fate of the poor and lowly born, whose souls are slowly eaten by the evil spirits who dwell inside the craters. "Why, Stephen, there you are," cried Jack, his grim face breaking into a smile. "I've kept half a pot of coffee for you, and I'm sure you could do with another, having watched so late. Your eyes are as red as a ferret's. Killick! Killick there! Another pot for the doctor!" "We're bounding along at a fine pace, are we not? At a rate of knots, I make no doubt. See how the table leans." "Pretty well. We've spread everything she can carry, perhaps even a little more than's quite wise. I felt so hellfire-hipped and mumpish in the channel with that parcel of goddamn lubbers nearly missing my tide that I longed for a breath of fresh air. Try one of these toasted slices of breadfruit. They eat well with coffee. The chief's sister sent me a netful dried." He slowly ate a piece of crisp breadfruit, drank out his cup and said, "Yet, you know, it's not made quite the difference I'd reckoned on. Perhaps it'll be better presently when we bring the breeze abaft the beam." The breeze, as he had foreseen, came abaft the beam late in the forenoon watch. The surprise spread her weather stunsails, and by the time the hands were piped to dinner, she was running at 8 knots 3 fathoms, fresh air in plenty, brilliant sun, and the taste of salt from the fine spindrift. The officers on the quarter-deck watched their captain pace fore and aft, as he paced fore and aft uncounted times, but they remained silent over there to leeward, and the men at the wheel and the quartermaster beside them stood unnaturally stiff as he passed by. "Captain Pullings, if you please," he said, after he'd walked his measured mile. "A word with you." In the cabin, Pullings said, "I'm glad you told me to come, sir. I was going to ask you to do the gunroom the honour of dining with us tomorrow, it being Sunday." "That's very kind of you, Tom," he said, looking him right in the eye, "but I must decline invitations to the gunroom at present. This is not a fling at you, however." "I'm afraid the last time was not all we could have wished," said Pullings, shaking his head. "No, Tom," said Jack, after a considerable pause, "the ship is falling to pieces. Where there is ill will, really strong ill will, in the gun room, a ship falls to pieces. Even when she's a company like this, I've known it again and again, so have you." "Yes, by God," said Tom. "I had thought of remedying it, at least to some extent, by making Oakes acting lieutenant." "Oh, no, sir," cried Pullings. He flushed, and his dreadful scar showed livid across his face. "It would add to the number at your table and make rudeness, gross incivility, less easy. It would put him on an even footing, which would prevent any officer from riding him and so angering the hands in Oakes's division. He would stand his own watch, which would make him independent. He's quite seaman enough for blue water sailing." Yes, sir, said Pullings. And then, barely audible in his embarrassment and protesting that he didn't mean to carry tales or inform on anyone, he said, but that would mean Mrs. Oakes messing with us. Of course, that's a part of my argument. Well, sir, some of the officers are sweet on Mrs. Oakes. I dare say they are, a very amiable young woman. No, sir. I mean serious. Bloody serious. Cut your throat serious. Fucking serious. Oh! Jack Aubrey was taken back entirely. But you surely don't mean that last word literally. No, sir. It's just my coarse way of speaking, I beg pardon, but so serious that if she were there at the table, day after day... After a silence, Jack said, the husband's always the last to know, they say. I'm talking of myself as being married to the barker, you understand. The sods. But I'm sure she never gave them any encouragement. Well, Tom, thank you for letting me know. I see things in a new light now. Yes, indeed. Now, passing on to the shameful bungling this morning, I shall speak to the officers concerned, but there were also some hands who behaved ill. Sullen and unwilling, neglect of duty. You must prepare a list and I must deal with them. A damned unpleasant business. He walked over to his chart table and measured off the distance yet to run to Oahu. We must pull them together before there's any question of action, he said. Tom, will you dine with me and the doctor tomorrow? And perhaps I might ask Martin and the Oakses. Thank you, sir. I should be very happy. I shall look forward to it, too. And, Tom, pray tell West and Davidge that I wish to see them. They were both expecting the summons. Jack had left the unmooring to them while he and Pullings finished their business with Wainwright below. And he had come on deck to find an everyday manoeuvre being shockingly bungled. But they hadn't expected this degree of cold fury, nor the far-reaching nature of his observations. I am speaking to you about your public life, he said. You know perfectly well that public ill will stirs up division and brings discredit on a ship. You also know that officers' disagreements in wardroom or gunroom are public, since the mess servants tell their mates directly so that they affect the whole ship's company, even if they are kept under hatches, since any officer with a division has a following among the hands in his charge. But you have not even attempted to keep things under hatches. You are openly, blatantly rude to one another, and you ride Oakes in a way that causes great resentment among his men, whom he looks after very well. Obviously, since your messmates are not talebearers, I have had no idea of your conduct in the gunroom. But you cannot deny that I have given you many a hint, aye, and many an open check these last weeks about your rudeness and incivility on deck. One result of all this ill-feeling, division and contention was today's disgraceful exhibition, where I came on deck and found you wrangling like a couple of fish fags and the ship looking like Bartholomew Fair. And all this in the presence of the Daisy's master and her people. I can only thank God there was no kingship by. Imagine such a state of affairs in action. Another result was that you disgraced the ship in your entertainment to Mrs. Oakes and her husband. You, both of you, West and Davidge, make your dislike of one another staringly obvious. You showed no respect for your guests in what was essentially a public function. For my own part, I have just declined Captain Pulling's invitation for tomorrow. I was half stunned at the time, sir, said Davidge. No doubt you presented your excuses to Oakes the next morning, said Jack. Davidge reddened, but made no reply. As for your personal private disagreements, I've nothing to say. But I do absolutely insist upon your keeping up public appearances, officer-like outward appearances. In the gunroom, when any hands are present, on deck at all times. I say nothing about my report to the Admiralty, but I do promise you this. Unless I find you have taken great notice of my words by the time we've dealt with Moahu, by God, you shall sow what you have reaped, and I shall supersede you by two of the master mariners from before the mast. We have at least a score. That will do. Dearest Sophie, he wrote, a captain worth his name knows a great deal about his ship, her capabilities, her stores, her weaknesses, and so on. And common daily observation shows him his people's seamanship and fighting qualities. But he lives so far from his officers and men that unless he listens to tale-bearers, there's a great deal he does not know. These last weeks I have been worried by the obvious ill-will in the gunroom and its bad effects on discipline. I had both directly and indirectly told them to be more civil, but only this morning did Tom, horribly confused at informing on his messmates, tell me the reason for this ill-will. I had thought it the usual weariness of a long commission with the same faces, the same jokes, perhaps sharpened by some foolish raillery carried too far, losses at cards, chess, arguments. But all this carried much farther than I should ever have let it go. I am much to blame. Yet this morning, just before I called them in to reprove them for the horrible mess they'd made of unmooring the ship, Tom let me know that they hated one another because of Mrs. Oakes, and that it wouldn't do to give Oakes an order as acting lieutenant, because with her at the table their rivalry might well break bounds. It is a shame that such a modest, well-conducted woman should be so persecuted and kept through the dismal, solitary messing of the midshipman's berth. I'm sure she's given no encouragement, even in the most harmless, usual shipboard way. Has never said, pray do up this button for me, my fingers are all thumbs, or I hope you don't think my tucker too low. No. And at a most discreditable dinner the gunroom gave for her, with half her hosts as mute as fishes, she kept things going most courageously. I do like courage in a woman. By the way, I was quite mistaken about Stephen when I feared he might be too fond. They went for a walk in the country yesterday and came back so pleased and affectionate together, carrying some extraordinary flowers and a bag of Stephen's birds and beetles. I have a mind to ask her and her husband to dine tomorrow to mark the point, but I'm not sure. I was so angered by seeing the ship exposed and mishandled this morning that I have little heart for entertaining. And Oakes himself, though a tolerable seaman, is a shocking drag. I shall ask Stephen. He's examining her in his cabin at this minute. Although Jack and Stephen had played some deeply satisfying music that evening, Stephen, sitting with his feet braced against the heel of the ship on a batten shipped for the purpose, and Jack standing to play his fiddle, the captain woke early in the morning watch on Sunday with the humiliation of his ship's disgrace still strong in his mind, and a clear recollection of Wainwright's silent astonishment and tactfully averted eyes when they came on deck. The wind had begun dropping through the middle watch, as some inner recorder told him, and he wasn't at all surprised to find the ship ghosting along under limp, dew-soaked sails over a grey sea with barely a ripple on the heavy swell from the south. "Good morning, Mr. Davidge," he said, taking the logboard from its place. "Good morning, Mr. Oakes." "Morning, sir," said Davidge. "Good morning, sir," said Oakes. Although there were stars and even their reflections in the west, the eastern sky was light enough for him to read the board, and from what the sky to starboard told, he saw the calm wouldn't last. "Have any sharks been seen?" he asked. Davidge hailed the lookout. No sharks at all, sir." "I'll just peep under the counter, sir," said Oakes. "Sometimes we have a messmate there." A moment later he called, "All clear, sir." "Thank you, Mr. Oakes," said Jack. He walked to the gangway stanchions, hung his shirt and trousers over the ridge rope, breathed deep and dived deeper. The bubbles hissed past him, his whole weight changed, and the water was cool enough to be wonderfully refreshing. He swam powerfully for half a mile, and turning he contemplated the ship, her trim, her perfect lines, as she rose and fell, sometimes disappearing altogether in the trough of the swell. The sun had now turned the whole sky blue, light blue, and he could feel its warmth on the back of his neck. Yet even so, some blackness remained. He didn't rejoice with the whole of his being. The abiding fury was wholly dissipated, however, when within 20 yards of the frigate he caught sight of Mrs. Oakes leaning over the quarter-deck rail far aft. "Heavens," he cried inwardly, "I may be seen naked." And he instantly dived, swimming as fast and far as he could on one breath. He needn't have feared, nor held his breath, to so near bursting point. Already Oakes was running in one direction to shield her eyes, and Killick with a towel in the other to shield his person. Killick, seeing his captain's approach from afar, had also timed his first breakfast with particular care, rather as a keeper obliged to live in the same cage with a testy, omnipotent lion might time his gobbets of horseflesh to the very first stroke of the zoological bell. For once, Stephen shared this first breakfast. He had been so much taken up with encoding that he hadn't looked at a tenth part of his botany specimens, nor even at all his birds and their parasites, with anything like really close attention, and the thought of them brought him out of his cot at first light with that almost trembling, or rather bubbling, excitement he'd known from early days. His first sight of St. Dubyuk's Heath when he was 7, of Adele filled with gold of pleasure the next year, and of the Pyrenean Desman, that rare, ill-natured cousin to the shrew, only a few weeks after that. "I was very near offering Mrs. Oakes a dreadful spectacle just now," said Jack, after a pause in which they drank 2 cups of coffee. "I was swimming back, was within pistol shot, when I noticed her there at the rail. Had she looked my way, she must have beheld a naked man." "That would have been very shocking indeed," said Stephen. "Pray pass the breadfruit toast." He remembered an earlier occasion on which Mrs. Oakes had, in fact, beheld a naked man through the scuttle of the cabin in which she had been examined, perfectly unmoved. Jack was standing in a boat giving directions about the recovery of a hawser cut by the sharp coral rock and on the point of diving himself, and she contemplated him with a detached interest. "Captain Aubrey would be considered a fine figure of a man even in Ireland, would he not?" she asked. "But surely he's been most dreadfully cut about. I should scarcely like to number the wounds I've sewn up and dressed, or the musket and pistol balls I've extracted," said Stephen. "You are to observe, ma'am, that they are all honourably in front, except for those that are behind." That was long before their walk in Anamooka. Indeed, it was the first time he had distinctly seen anything unusual in her attitude towards men, an almost clinical attitude that disconcerted him to some degree, since neither her face nor her everyday behaviour was marked by any irregularity of life. He was still thinking of her when Jack said, "Speaking of Mrs. Oakes, it's long since I heard her howling on Martin's viola. Or Martin himself, for that matter. I believe I understood him to say that the neck was out of order, or possibly the head. How does it come about, do you suppose, that so few people play it? For a score that make their attempts upon a fiddle, not more than one, nay less, tries the viola. Yet it has, or can have, the sweetest voice." "I cannot tell, I'm sure. Perhaps they're less easy to come by. Perhaps they're even more difficult to master. Think how rare it is to find a player of the very first rate, fit to answer a violin like Kramer or Kreutzer in, say, Mozart. Come in. Come in and sit down, Tom. he called, pouring him a cup of coffee. "Thank you, sir. It was only that I forgot to ask whether you meant to ring church today." "Yes," said Jack, his face clouding again. "Yes, certainly. There's nothing like church for bringing a sense of order into things. But only the penitential psalms and the articles." Church, by all means, with awnings over the quarterdeck. Yet before church came the ceremony of divisions, the formal inspection of all hands lined up under their divisional offices and of their quarters. It was, as Jack had observed, one of a commander's best opportunities for taking the ship's company's pulse. As he passed along the ranks, he looked eye to eye at every seaman, petty officer, and warrant officer aboard. And he would be a dull fellow if the expression, or lack of expression, on the scores of well-washed, new-shaven faces didn't give him some notion of the ship's general temper. This worked both ways. The surprises also gauged the state of their captain's mind. And his progress, accompanied by pullings and by each divisional officer in turn, left gloom and dismay behind. In spite of his bathe, in spite of his breakfast, and in spite of the fine, steady breeze, there was still a great deal of anger and resentment in his heart. The ship had been mishandled, made to look ridiculous. All that unofficer-like, unseaman-like swearing and shouting and noise in the course of an everyday manoeuvre that the old surprise would have carried through without the slightest fuss and with little more than the single order unmoor ship, would have carried it through like a man-o'-war rather than a slapdash privateer. It was a desecration. And very strong displeasure emanated from him as he walked along. He smiled only once. And that was when he came to the gunner's division, where Mr. Smith was attended by Reed, making his first official appearance since his accident. "I'm happy to see you again, Mr. Reed," he said. "You have the doctor's leave, I'm sure." "Oh, yes, sir. He declared I was quite fit for—" began Reed, but here his voice, which had just started to break, soared out of control before he brought out "light duties" in a deep croak. "Very good, but even so, you must take care. We don't have so very many seamen aboard. On to Oakes and the foretopman." A division that had always been the most cheerful in the ship and that was now the most disturbed. Guilt accounted for some part of their trouble, as it did for their more than usually high perfection of cleanliness and Sunday dress. Gestures towards averting wrath. But there was also something more that he couldn't define. He walked along past them with a grave face and none of the small remarks that so often attended divisions. On to the forecastle men, and so to Jemmy Ducks and his charges. "How they shoot up," he reflected. "Perhaps Fanny and Charlotte will be as long in the leg by now." Although he looked at them kindly and asked them how they did, they gazed up with even more anxiety than usual. In their very remote Melanesian small childhood, formal gatherings had sometimes ended in human sacrifice. A reasonable foundation for uneasiness. But in addition to this, they were more exactly in tune with the people's mood than their captain, and so, raising upon the foundation to an uncommon height, they quavered as they replied. In the empty sick berth, Stephen and Martin sat carefully in their good clothes, listening to the sound of Padin putting the last touches of polish and exact order to the surgical instruments. Breaking the silence, Martin said in a low tone, "I owe you a fuller explanation for my conduct yesterday. I didn't go with you and Mrs. Oakes because for some time now I felt, how shall I put it, an inclination, a growing inclination for her that it would be criminal to indulge. I felt I must avoid her company even at the cost of a falseness and incivility that I do assure you, Maturin, I very much regret. Never in life, my dear Martin, said Stephen, shaking him by the hand, sure it's better to flee than to pardon. And from the mere philosophical, as opposed to the moral point of view, we covered rather more ground. For the same reason I broke my viola, said Martin, still with his first idea. Then, the second having pierced through, he clapped his hand to his pocket and cried, very true. And at one point in our return, when Dr. Falconer and I were sitting among old and rotting tree trunks felled by some long-past hurricane, a kind of locality you didn't encounter, I collect, I found a large variety of beetles. Here, producing a flat box from his pocket, is a selection I beg you will accept. Stephen opened the box and tilted it to the filtered light. Here's glory for you, he cried. Longicorns to a man. No, no. These must belong to the Clarede. Such colours. How they make Sir Joseph stare, and how grateful I am. They're all dead, I find. Yes. I cannot bear that perpetual hopeless striving to escape the scrabbling noise, so I pass them through spirits of wine.
Gentleman, dear himself, is upon us, said Padine in a nervous whisper, and of course in Irish, thrusting his head through the hatch like a rabbit and withdrawing it at once.
Perhaps I should tell you that Captain Aubrey means to invite you to dine with Pullings, the Oakses, and myself, said Stephen. Oh, thank you, said Martin with a harassed smile. Now that I'm forewarned, I believe I can keep my countenance for the space of a dinner. Yet when Jack, having gone through the motions of inspecting the sick berth, said, Mr. Martin, may we hope for the pleasure of your company at dinner today? Martin replied, Alas, sir, I must beg to be excused. I am very far from well, and shall absent myself even from church. But allow me to say how very sensible I am of your goodness. Far from well. Indeed, a man must be uncommonly disordered to decline an invitation from both his patron and his commanding officer. The refusal of a captain's invitation to dinner was extremely unusual in the service, an act assumed to be a declaration of hostility, very near neighbour to mutiny, if not to high treason. But Jack, who couldn't look upon either Martin or Stephen as a truly maritime animal, took it quite calmly, suggested that perhaps he had ate something in Anamooka, recommended lying down. A man's pillow is his best medicine, though I shouldn't say so in the present company. Asked his advice on the more lowering psalms, and carried on with his inspection. As he and Pullings walked forward along the cable tier, a rat crossed their path, and Jack cried, Bless me! It was here that we found Mrs. Oakes looking like a boy. That was, in fact, no great while ago, in time or course made good, if you consider. Yet now she seems as much part of the ship as the figurehead. Pullings, who worshipped and detested the figurehead equally and in torment, uttered a murmur of assent, and after a while Jack went on. Where did she get those trousers from, do you imagine? They were much too small for Oakes. They belonged to poor Miller, sir, said Pullings, speaking of a midshipman killed in Jack's most recent action. And when his things were sold at the mainmast, Reed bought the uniform, hoping he would grow into them when we were in New South Wales. But, however, he did not, and I suppose he passed them on. I only speak adventure, sir. I have no real knowledge, he added, unwilling to have the air of an informer. It's very likely, said Jack, calling young Miller to mind. They were much of a size. He said no more until they were in the light of day once more, a light so brilliant that it caused them to narrow their eyes, but that also made it clear to the ship's people that nothing had happened below to change their skipper's state of mind, and that they still had a right tartar on their hands. Jack Aubrey's large, open, florid, blue-eyed face couldn't by any contortion be made to look shrewish or mean. But indignation for his ship and deep anger against the men who could have used her so gave it a leonine ferocity that had a wonderfully daunting effect. It didn't change during divine service, an austere ritual unrelieved by the presence of the Reverend Nathaniel Martin, who, though no hand at a sermon, added a greater humanity than was present today. After the regulation prayers, read in a strong, unforgiving tone, and the sin-confessing psalm, the surprises heard their captain raise his already powerful voice a pitch or two, and run through the dreadful articles of war in a tone less forgiving still. He dwelt with more than usual emphasis on the words, "If any officer, marine, soldier, or other person in the fleet shall presume to quarrel with any of his superior officers being in the execution of his office, or shall disobey any lawful command of any of his superior officers, every such person being convicted shall suffer death." And on, "If any person in the fleet shall quarrel or fight with any other person in the fleet, or use reproachful or provoking speeches or gestures tending to make any quarrel or disturbance, he shall, upon being convicted thereon, suffer such punishments as the offence shall deserve." And on, "No person in or belonging to the fleet shall negligently perform the duty imposed upon him or forsake his station upon pain of death." Mrs. Oakes and the little girls being present, he skipped Article 29, which dealt with sodomy by hanging the sodomite, but he came out strong on 36. "All other crimes not capital, which are not mentioned in this Act, or for which no punishment is hereby directed to be inflicted, shall be punished according to the laws and customs in such cases used at sea," ending with a glare at the congregation that reminded them of the more brutal customs used at sea, such as keel-hauling. And that caused Emily, who was less stout than Sarah, and who had seen Jemmy Duck's change of countenance, to start grizzling again. After this and the midday observation, he dismissed them to eat their dinner with what appetite they could summon with the help of grog, and began the most recent in a long, long series of measured miles on the windward side of his quarterdeck. Heart of Oak beat for the diminished gunroom dinner. Martin retired to his cabin with two concealed biscuits. The captain paced on and on in his elegant white waistcoat, as grave as a hanging judge. It didn't foretell a particularly cheerful dinner party. Yet Jack had a high notion of hospitality. Apart from anything else, on his first introduction to the Navy, he had served under a nephew of the amiable Admiral Boscawen, a commander who carried on his uncle's tradition, famous throughout the service, a tradition that suited the natural bent of Captain Aubrey's genius, so that when Killick came to tell him that the doctor was square-rigged and powdered, that his honour's coat was hanging on the back of his chair, and that his guests were at single anchor, he brightened at once, hurried down the companion ladder and into what was officially his sleeping place, now for so small a party turned into his dining cabin with its usual blaze of silver, Killick's joy, among the orchids, and his own coat hunched at the head of the table. He put it on, splendid with gold lace and epaulettes, gave the table and the great cabin a quick glance, and walked into the coach, where his meagre store of gin, bitters and Madeira stood ready to receive his guests. They arrived in a body, and a little civil war of declining precedence could be heard on the half-deck. The war was lost before it began, however, and they walked in according to established order. Mrs. Oakes, the Scarlet Woman, as the Sethians and some others called her, came first in a modified version of her wedding dress. She dropped Aubrey the prettiest straight-backed curtsy, exactly timed to the frigate's roll, and made room for Tom Pullings, almost as glorious as a post-captain. Then came Stephen, who, as a mere surgeon, a warrant officer, had no lace at all on his plain blue coat, though he was allowed an embroidered buttonhole to his collar. And last of all, Oakes, who had no precedence of any kind and whose only ornament was the extreme brilliance of his polished buttons. He was, nevertheless, the most cheerful of the band, smiling and chuckling to himself. He'd obviously fortified himself for the encounter with grog. And when Jack asked Clarissa what he might bring her, she said she would be happiest if she might be allowed to share her husband's Madeira in so wifely a manner that the married men, even Killick and his mate, smiled inwardly. But when, on the stroke of the bell, they moved into the dining cabin, Clarissa was seated on Jack's right, with Pullings opposite her, and Stephen at her side. Oakes was on Pullings' left, removed from her by a broad expanse of tablecloth. It's true that he often looked at her with a dog-like devotion, and her glance sometimes made him call belay, when Killick hadn't even half filled his glass. Yet neither being stinted of his wine nor the foreboding atmosphere in the ship affected his spirits, and it appeared to Stephen, his vis-à-vis, that something must very recently have passed between him and Clarissa. A new understanding, perhaps physically ratified. "Doctor," he said, leaning over the table with a smile, "you're a very learned cove. But do you know what it is, that the more you cut of it, grows still the longer?" Stephen considered with his head on one side, took a sip of wine, and in the expectant silence he asked, "Would it be celery at all?" "No, sir. Not celery," said Oakes with great satisfaction. Others suggested hay, a beard, nails, and Killick whispered in Stephen's ear, "Try horseradish, sir." But none would do, and in the end, as soup was clearing away, Oakes had to tell them that the more you cut of a ditch, the longer the ditch grew. They confessed it. Even Pullings, rising from his state of guilt at the frigate's present condition, said it was very clever, one of the cleverest things he'd heard. And Jack looked at Oakes with a new esteem. On the half-deck, as the fish was coming aft, Killick could be heard explaining the apparent paradox to his mate in Jack Nastyface. Oakes wore his triumph modestly throughout the fish, a noble creature like a bonito, but with crimson spots. And during this time, Jack explained the theory of trade winds to Clarissa, while Pullings listened with a fixed look of polite attention, and Stephen attended to the fish's anatomy. "Doctor," said Oakes, having wiped his plate, "do you remember the Bathurst Tavern in Sydney? Well, there was a soldier that used to come down with a couple of friends, and we played halfpenny whist. And after every two or three rubbers, he would call for a pipe of tobacco. Then one day, no pipe. 'Ain't you going to smoke?' we asked him. 'No,' says he. 'I lit my pipe last night with a broadsheet ballad folded lengthways, and there's been a singing in my head ever since. I'm sure it's the ballad still.'" Stephen noticed an anxious expression on Clarissa's face, but her husband, enchanted by the reception of his piece, missed her look and plunged on into an account of a man who wore his hair over his shoulders and who, on being asked by a bald companion why he let it grow so long, answered it was to see if his hair would run to seed, that he might sow it on bald pates. Very good, Mr. Oakes," cried Jack, beating his hand on the table. "A glass of wine with you, sir." During the roast pork, he drank to each of his guests, particularly to Clarissa, whose looks he thought much improved from their exposure to the sun and the breeze. "So, returning to my trade winds, ma'am," he went on, "presently I hope we shall meet those blowing from the northeast, and then you shall see what the ship can do, for we shall have to beat to windward tack upon tack, and she's a good plier. There's nothing she loves better than sailing close-hauled into a fine steady gale." "Oh, I should love that," said Clarissa. "There's nothing so exalting as clinging on with both hands when the ship leans right over and the spray comes dashing back right along the side. She spoke with unfeigned enthusiasm, and he gave her an approving look. More than approving, indeed. And he quickly dropped his eyes in case his admiration should be seen. "Doctor," he called down the table, "the bottle stands by you." Oakes had been silent for some time. He was silent while the plum duff was passing round. He was silent while it was being eaten. But on swallowing his last spoonful, he raised his glass, and smiling happily round at the company, he said, "So long as we may, let us enjoy this breath, for naught doth kill a man so soon as death." On the other hand, there was little merriment on the forecastle and the last dog-watch, though the evening was calm, beautiful, and in every way fit for the dancing so usual at this time of day on a Sunday. Only the little girls played the northern version of hopscotch they'd learned from the Orkneymen, played it quietly, watched by the seamen with barely a comment. There was, if anything, less on the quarter-deck. And when Stephen came up a little before sunset, he found Davidge, the officer of the watch, standing by the barricade, looking haggard, middle-aged, wretched, and Clarissa sitting in her usual place by the taffrail, quite alone. "I'm so glad you've appeared," she said. "I was growing as melancholy as a gib-cat, which is ungrateful after such a splendid dinner. And very strange, too, because I never minded being by myself when I was a girl, and I longed for nothing so much as solitude in New South Wales. Perhaps I feel it here because I do so dislike being disliked. Reed and Sarah and Emily, we were such friends, and I cannot think how I've offended them. The young are notoriously fickle." "Yes, I suppose so, but it is disappointing. Look, the sun's about to touch the sea." When the last orange rim had gone and the rays alone were shooting up into the lemon-coloured haze, she said, "I suppose a sea captain's life must be a very lonely one. Of course, it's different for Captain Aubrey with you aboard, but for most of them, cooped up with nobody to talk to. Do many take their wives or mistresses to sea?" "Wives are uncommon, almost unheard of on long voyages, I believe. And mistresses are, in general, disapproved of by everyone, from the Lords of the Admiralty to the ordinary seamen. They take away from an officer's character and his authority." "Do they really? Yet neither seamen nor naval officers are famous for chastity." "Not by land. Yet at sea a different set of rules comes into play. They are neither particularly logical nor consistent, but they are widely understood and observed." "Really? Really?" she asked, leaning forward with intense interest. Then she sighed and shook her head, saying, "But then, as you're aware, I know so little about men. Men in the ordinary sense, in ordinary, everyday life. Men by day rather than by night.